This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena the better to understand how society works. Each week we discuss a classic text, theme or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. Sharat is still off. But we are joined this week by Dr. Muhammad Faiz Abdullah. He is an independent scholar who recently released a book called The Province of Sharia Determined, Fundamental Rethink of the Sharia, released by IBT Press. And we're going to discuss this very, very interesting book. Welcome to the show, Dr. Faiz.
Thank you. Welcome. Yes, this is my first encounter in this kind of scenario.
So you've never been on radio before?
You have to forgive me. I've been on the radio in a way that was not up to my intention, because once in a while you get songs being done. I used to do a couple of songs here and there.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Yes. Interesting. So you have a musical background?
Well, kind of like, yeah, wannabe, you know. Ended up in a different profession in the end, yes.
Which is very interesting to me, because you also have a background in literature and philosophy.
Yes.
I mean, you're a humanities person.
Yeah, in a way,
most
yes.
Part, right?
Liberal arts. That was my first calling and still remains the most important part, actually. Yeah. Yes.
So what ushered this transition to legal theory and legal scholarship? Because it sounds, I mean, people would say that these are very different endeavors, right? Because the humanities is about expression, creativity, loosening of boundaries in terms of disciplines. But the law is about precision, using words properly, understanding the black and white, right? Yeah. So tell us a bit about your intellectual journey.
You hit it right on the head, actually, at the same time by saying that you exposed two major myths, if mm-hmm. I may just put it that
sure,
way.
Sure, sure.
Which is a common one, which I used to subscribe to myself. First of all, there is no bifurcation in terms of the liberal arts as well as the law, and in particular, Sharia. And that is one of the main themes I wanted to push, and I hope that message gets across. Secondly, there was no jump. In fact, I wanted to be a lawyer, but my grades were not good enough, so I ended up doing arts. Put it in place. Now, that is heaven sent, in the sense that because of that, I was exposed to a lot more than I would have had if I had started with the law. Mm-hmm. Even though in law, there's quite a bit of philosophy involved.
Right.
If one goes on to jurisprudence. But that was an excellent start. Mm-hmm. So when I finished my career, when I moved from one career to another, I started as a journalist. After my English degree. The great thing about the English degree then, as opposed to now, I believe, is that we were exposed to a wide field. Mm-hmm. Not just literature, but philosophy as well.
Interesting.
And that when we got exposed to continental philosophy, mm-hmm. my first exposure was Descartes.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, it was quite a huge jump. And then from there, we went backwards, going back to the pre-Socratics. Mm-hmm. We did Plato and the others. All holiday reading, mm-hmm. and not part of the prescribed reading.
Interesting.
So that's how it is. So I hope that really answers the question. There's no real transition. Mm-hmm. It's a continuous process.
So where was that curriculum exactly? You were locally educated?
Yes. Oh. I did it at one of the early batches of the English department of University of Malaya.
Interesting.
So we had very good exposure. We started with, yep. with no Chaucer, yep. all the way to the moderns. Yep. I don't know what it is right now, but yep. During then, it was under the late Lloyd Fernando at the time, mm-hmm. Professor mm-hmm. Lloyd Fernando.
So let's touch on that point that you raised earlier about how liberal arts and the law are not as separate or as distant as we think. Yeah. Let's start with the basics then. Why do people think it is normally?
Well, there are two ways of looking. One is, if you're just talking about law in general, that's one aspect. If you're talking about law as in Sharia, that's another dimension mm-hmm, to it. Mm-hmm. Though the paths don't really diverse. The idea is that people seem to think that Sharia law, Western jurisprudence are kind of like diametrically opposed. Mm-hmm. They're not. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're opposed because juristic thinking seems to push it that way. Mm-hmm. Essentially, they're not. Coming back to that first question, law is a reflection of civilization. So would be the works in liberal arts and the humanities. Mm-hmm. So both of them basically draw from the same source. Mm-hmm. As long as they are human beings and we're talking about conscious human beings, there will be law and there will be liberal arts. Mm-hmm. So there's no bifurcation at all.
Yeah. So speaking of bifurcations then, let's focus on that connection more closely between the Western tradition of the law and the Sharia tradition. I know that they started from very different geographical locations, and people are perceiving that they are very, very opposed, right? So what is your position on the relationship? You don't seem to think that they're very opposed, so you seem to think that they're very overlapping. What's your stance there?
Yeah, my position is quite clear. In fact, if you look at law, Western jurisprudence, they started with natural law. Mm-hmm. Natural law was just another way of saying that it's relation to God's law, except that when you start using phrases like God's law in Western jurisprudence, you'd be castigated into certain categories. Mm-hmm. For example, you'd be castigated into the conservatives or those who are morally bent. And then in modern parlance, you'd be considered those who are theologically oriented. Mm-hmm. And in the case of, for example, I just give you a break up to the most modern situation here, like in the U.S., those in the Bible Belt, mm-hmm. you do not separate law and morality, for example, because people go to church, the Bible is very important, and in the Bible, there'll be a lot of injunctions pertaining to what you should do, what you should not do. Mm-hmm. But that's the way law has developed eventually. Now, in the case of the Sharia, first and foremost, the term is used, quote-unquote, God's law. Mm-hmm. In fact, many of the books, when they use it in that sense, is used in a negative light, as if they are trying to, you know, make fun of the term God's law. But I have a very, very, one of the most important books written by a non-Muslim, which is essentially starts with God's law and it goes deep into it. And it translates one of the major texts used in the Shafi'i mm-hmm. jurisprudence. And they make it very clear that to the Western mind now, there seems to be a problem with God's law. But it goes further to say that, but you look at it conservatively, the Greco-Roman tradition, the Jewish Christian tradition had that very essential element known as the lex divina, which is just another way of saying it's God's law. Mm-hmm. And you go back to the Sharia, traditionally it would be God's law in relation to legal principles derived directly from the Quran and the Sunnah. Mm-hmm. That would be God's law. And between that and what goes on after that, by the ulama, by the fuqaha, by the so-called mujtahid, those are essentially basically juristic practitioners. Their interpretation of the law should not be put in the same category as God's law. Mm-hmm. And that's where much of the problem lies.
Yeah. Well, some would say the fundamental disagreement there is that natural law today, or even say in its earliest conception, was more focused on what was considered natural or of quote-unquote human propriety, right? Yeah. So the idea is that whatever is right and wrong has to be in accordance with human nature, what fits human nature, rather. And that today, when we talk about natural law, that conception of human nature is no longer dependent on scripture, right? Whereas Sharia law, I know that there's this subsequent tradition of interpreters, of people who would revise previous rulings, so on and so forth, but it is still tied to a particular notion of human being that is the creation of God, so on and so forth. So I get it that, sure, the Western canon is linked to religion. There's always some sort of divine assumption in its history. But by now, after secularization, after modernity, that is no longer in effect, right? The idea that God's word has to inform every decision is no longer part of the process, right? And whereas that's still debatable in the Sharia.
True, true.
Yeah.
It's all a matter of degree. Mm-hmm. I think you've got it right to say that the question of whether God's scheme of things would come into in relation to, for example, the articulation of the law. Mm-hmm. I think, first of all, we've got to clarify here when we say God's law, we don't have to rule out God's law. We only have to rule out God's law in relation to questions of positive law. Mm-hmm. See, for the Muslim, law is law governing all aspects of his or her life, basically. But when it comes to positive law in relation to or in the context of, say, the administration of a state, then many issues come into being. For example, when you say God's law, are you talking about criminal law as well? And when you talk about criminal law, to what extent does this scope of criminal law be covered in relation to, say, offences pertaining to against the human body, offences against a corporation, offences against a state? Mm-hmm. So the question is all about scope and degree. Mm-hmm. Correct. You do not separate the element of the divinity in relation to law that is derived from the Quran, especially, and some major aspects of the Sunnah. And clear aspects which are derived from the Quran and the Sunnah, we have to look into the sources of the law. Mm-hmm. I think it will be remiss of us to just you know, plunge headlong in discussing Sharia law without understanding some basic concepts.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the misunderstanding of basic concepts is one of the root causes of the failure to see Sharia as a dynamic corpus of law.
So what would you say is the best place to start in terms of clarifying some of these misconceptions? What would be the most enigmatic term, for example?
There are no shortcuts. I think, first of all, we have to go back to first principles.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, like everybody says, a little bit of knowledge, yeah, can be pretty risky business. So what we do is, that's also one of the purposes of my book, is to, first of all, you know, try to seek some clarity. People use terms like Sharia, for example, in the modern context now, and it conjures up this, you know, mullahs, you know, carrying Kalashnikovs, and, you know, mullahs trying to chop off your hands. That conception has got to be erased. And much of the conception, unfortunately, is also contributed by the ulama themselves. Mm-hmm. So we have to start with first principles to know what is the Sharia, what is fiqh. There has got to be a difference. And when you say divine law, what do you mean by divine law or God's law? Then we go into basically the concept of the dynamism of the Sharia, mm-hmm. which is the doctrine of the ijtihad, mm-hmm. the exercise of intellectual effort in relation to a question of law which has not been decided.
Mm-hmm.
That is, of course, still the old paradigm. Mm-hmm. The new paradigm says that it cannot be constrained to this, you know, matter of law or questions of law only. The new paradigm says that you can go beyond that, questions of law. What about society? What about ethos? What about morality? What about civilizational?
Mm-hmm.
So it should not be confined to that. Let me just get back to the other issue. So when we deal with that, these are the basic terms that have to be understood in addition to knowing the basic sources of the law.
Mm-hmm.
So when people talk about, you cannot have Sharia, what are they talking about? Are you saying that Muslims should not follow the Quran? They should not follow the Sunnah? They should not follow the various schools
mm-hmm.
that they are affiliated to, the Madhab or the Madhahib? Yeah? Are you saying they are supposed to reject all this? And which part are they supposed to reject? And in place of that, are you telling them that they must accept another paradigm such as Western law?
Mm-hmm.
So these are the things that are actually facing civilization, facing communities, the misunderstanding of which has led to unnecessary conflict.
So I get it that there are misconceptions around the Sharia. Mm-hmm. I get it that it's healthy to have a debate around its merits
mm-hmm.
in an informed way, that we need to know these fundamental concepts that it works around. But there's also the second part of the discussion, in that people are still not quite sure, because we haven't seen a working model yet, what it offers as an alternative to the weakness or the limitations of the Western law,
yeah.
you know. And I'm with you, at least at an intellectual level, that we don't want to reduce this rich tradition to just being about mullahs wanting to chop people's hands or wanting to stone yeah. people, right? But the question here is, how robust is it that it can be considered at the same level of Western law, despite its problems, right? We know that yeah. the Western juridical model is problematic, right? And I'm the first to say that, being trained in critical theory after reading Foucault and all that,
yes.
you see that, okay, there's a lot of issues here. But in a realistic level, if there are alternatives, should Sharia be one resource?
Yeah, that's good. I think before answering that, I think let's get some perspective. If you care to read my chapter, the last chapter on this, I try to sum up the whole scenario. And the first thing we have to get to be very clear about this is that there are two broad positions. Let's just look at the two extremes here. Number one, there is what we call the school that says Sharia is the be-all and the end-all for humankind. So it caters to the complete needs and requirements of the ummah. That is the usual refrain. Any attempts at trying to reinterpret the Sharia text within the modern context is considered to be secularizing the Sharia. That's one extreme. Now let's look at the other side. The other side says, the adoption of the Sharia is equivalent to legalization of irrationalism. Yeah? Legalization of the violation of human rights is the death of constitutional liberties. And it's basically equivalent to adopting the law of the desert. Now, we have got two polarities here. Yeah, then there are arguments why this is not so, why we can counter this and why we can counter that. With that, I'll come to your question. There'll be those who are saying that, well, these are the great things about Sharia, and historically it has been proven to be effective, so on and so forth, going back to the past. and the ideals are there, the principles are there, quite very much related to what you were saying there. You have got this. What is there to show? In fact, you've just picked that exact, or more or less that quote from what I've written there. What is there to show after 1400 years? Do we have a system of Sharia which is past muster that what we have now? Let's just not even try to compare it with Western jurisprudence. There's no need. Just compare to what we want, for example. Is there a system that basically guarantees constitutional liberties, matters like normocracy, rule of law, basic things? Yeah? Or does it have a complete social economic system? What is there in terms of the financial system that the Sharia can offer? Of course, they will say, yeah, we have now great things like the Sukuk and the financial instruments. But there are critics who say that these are basically rebranding exercises. Mm-hmm. Because when push comes to shove, in fact, some of the things there shows that, there's the other view, but there's one view to say that, in fact, conventional system is actually better for the Muslim. That is arguable. That's not the issue. But the point is, it is there. So, no, we have to get back to the same problem between the idea and the reality falls that great shadow, as T.S. Eliot would say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think we stop at that first to sure. give ourselves a certain rest here because before it gets too heavy. Yeah,
yes. Let's take a break. Pause for a bit, and we'll return second part of the show to pick up from where you left off on the ideal and the reality of what we call the Sharia and unpack its implications. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, joined by Dr. Faiz Abdullah. We are discussing the Sharia and its misconceptions, and this is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and this is Night School. And we have in the studio with us today Dr. Faiz Abdullah, an independent scholar who recently released his book. It's very fascinating. It's called The Province of Sharia Determined: Fundamental Rethink of the Sharia. And it's released by IBT Books. And it's really exploring all the key questions and arguments around the debates around the Sharia, whether it's compatible with modern system, what it offers, some of the most damaging misconceptions it has, and how we can better understand its rich tradition. And in the first part of the show, we left off at the question of ideals and reality, and my concern always is not so much the intellectual part. I think every rich religious tradition will have something to offer, and there's a lot that I think we can learn from it. The question here is in terms of where we are today, given the rapid changes in society and technology, so on and so forth, if a restructuring of the current system, for example, informed by certain virtues of the Sharia system, offers much substance, I guess. I'm just playing a skeptical role here. So beyond its intellectual merits, what does it really offer in terms of proper and substantive improvements?
Good, yeah. I'm glad you raised that issue because I think just before we took the break, it sounded like I was trying to be the devil's advocate on the other side, whereas the title of my book is, The Province of Sharia Determined. Well, there's no devil's advocate here. What we're trying to do here is to basically try to look at the thing in perspective. See, the trouble with overzealousness is you can go one way and you can go the other way. So I think at this time it would be proper to talk about this internal dynamics of the Sharia. And one of the greatest aspects of it is known as the doctrine of Islah. It usually is used together, Islah and Tajdeed, or Tajdeed and Islah, which is just renewal and reform. Let me just talk a little bit about this, of what's really happening now. You have this great scholar known as Sheikh Muhammad al-Ghazali, not Imam al-Ghazali. Mm-hmm. This is, I think you would be familiar. He's considered one of the progressives. Now, he has advocated, for example, that, of course, it's controversial. Yeah, he says that wherever a hadith is in conflict with the Quranic teaching, it loses the validity regardless of the strength of its transmission. I mean, the firm point is that he's saying that, there is a firm call for the Quran to be returned to its rightful place as the supreme arbiter of the authenticity of the hadith itself. So this is a good start. And he cites a very good example, for example, the case of the American engineer who was killed in Saudi Arabia. I think this is interesting for me to just talk a little bit about this. Yeah. So in that case, the Qadi ruled that Qisas, the law of the Lex Talionis, which is essentially Christian, especially Judeo law, Yeah, but with some variations.
Can you explain what that is? For
yeah, that is basically, you know, we have the law of Thelonious, eye for an eye, life for a life. And if we look, go back into the Old Testament, the strictures are even more severe than what is in the Quran. The Quran is pretty clear about what would be the equivalence in terms of punishment. So in this case, apparently there was a hadith which says that, you know, la yu'talu muslimuna fi kafirin, translated as there shall be no killing, or in this case there shall be no capital punishment, yeah, of a Muslim in respect of the killing of an unbeliever. Yeah, of course, if you take this to the logical conclusion, literally what it means is that this guy will get away scot-free because he's a Muslim and the one who dies is a non-Muslim. So now they're faced with this situation. Yeah, what are they going to do about this? Well, some sense came into that the Saudi government was forced into bypassing this so-called strict interpretation of the Sharia by invoking the principle of Siyasa al-Sharia. I've spent some time writing this in one of my chapters here on Siyasa al-Sharia, which is basically trying to use Sharia, not literally, but the spirit of the Sharia, and apply it to new situations when it comes to legislative improvements.
I hear that so much, you know, the spirit of the Sharia, but how would you characterize that?
Yeah, good. The spirit of the Sharia, there are two elements. Number one is Sharia, or basically Islam itself, in the Quran it says, is a blessing to mankind. Blessing means mercy. So when you interpret the law or when you introduce laws, it must praise the primacy of the human being's welfare, the institution of the family, the well-being of the society, the protection of life, as of paramount importance. That's number one. Number two, there's a principle that there is ease. Whenever you come across difficulty, Allah gives you ease. That itself is the spirit of the Sharia, which means that you make laws to make life easier and not to make life more difficult. Yeah, that would be the two overriding principles. It is not a dalil. In other words, according to the old paradigm of legal interpretation, it cannot be used as a basis for a hukum or a law itself. But the progressive idea of looking at it is to say that, why not? You use that as a general basis, as long as the outcome is not in violation of the Quran or the Sunnah.
Right.
So that is a progressive view.
In that sense, I see a certain advantage in the highly impersonal and highly abstract assumptions behind, I guess, Western law, right? Yeah. In a sense where if you say mercy and ease, already you admit of a relation, you admit of some minimal level of empathy and, you know, taking into consideration situations and contexts. I don't know why, I'm just thinking out loud. I'm not a legal scholar.
No, go on, I want to catch up on this. Yeah. Go on, first complete.
So I just sense that as well, because one of the virtues...
You're talking sense, you're not talking nonsense, don't worry. Yes.
One of the virtues, or one of the virtues claimed about the Western canon is that it is as abstract and neutral as possible in any case, right? Yes. Whereas this, when you personalize it, because I can't see a mercy that is impersonal, right? I can't see how you can exercise ease without some recognition of certain kind of investment in the case, right? So is that in the ballpark?
That is a
fair
observation. That is a fair observation, but it has to be contextualized in terms of Western jurisprudence. There is also a misconception. Like we started earlier, we talk about natural law. Even in English common law, for example, there is a misconception as if that it is just positive law, and if it's positive law, it has got to be based on whether it's right or wrong, black or white. That is the so-called law in inverted commas. But then if you look at it historically, because of the natural law influence, there is this thing known as equity, even in law, except that in most cases it applies to commercial transactions and more civil cases. But the point is that element of mercy, that element of trying to grant ease when things are difficult, is already there. Yeah, for example, you have a situation where the judge says that if I were to apply strict law here, the decision would go against this poor guy. He has signed a contract, is in black and white, there was no gun pointed to his head. For all intents and purposes, it looked like a voluntary contract, and therefore he has to pay, or he has to suffer, or his house has got to be pawned off or repossessed and so on. Then you have the element of equity. We say, hang on. Well, there is no gun pointed to his head, but we look at this economic situation. He was under duress. He had no choice but to take this contract. So the element of equity comes in, and the judge says, yeah, maybe there's room for me to play around. And they go back into some precedents to say that, well, there are actual cases where the judge, you know, departs from the strict law and applies that. So it is not totally correct to say that Western canon or the Western jurisprudence, and in fact in Europe they have the doctrine of good faith as well. Mm-hmm. This is a separate issue. If I may just insert this.
Sure.
In my next book, I will be dealing exactly with the questions that you raised.
Yeah.
I call it the clash of jurisprudence. Yeah.
Yeah. I do wonder though if the contextual difference has to be taken into account in the sense that Western jurisprudence has had to reckon with explosion of populations, yeah, questions of nation-state boundaries, and you have just a much more complex society where efficiency has to be taken into account, right? Whereas we haven't seen that model, the perfected model of the Sharia,
yeah,
having to reckon with those kinds of questions. Could it just be that the so-called dynamism, the Sharia system, the Sharia worldview can claim has a lot to do with that? It's never really had to work under duress at the kind of volume and pace that the secular system has to do every day.
Yeah, probably, if you're only looking at historical in the present context. But if you look at the golden age of Islam, you know, relatively speaking, you're talking about the pace of civilizational progress far exceeds what's happening now. If you're talking in terms of the dynamics... Yeah, you may want to disagree. You may be skeptical, but I don't want to go to razzmatazz and say how great it was. But I'm trying to say that the internal dynamics was there. Now, why is it not present now? It is not present now because we are still, or there is some, we are looking only at the infancy of Islamic Renaissance. Now, what is this Islamic Renaissance all about? This Islamic Renaissance is essentially going for a rethinking of the Sharia, and not to look at the Sharia constrained by historical precedents, to think that only matters which have been decided by the jurists can be applied and therefore cast in stone, yeah, but to look at it in terms of a reinterpretation, to put it within the context of modernity and contemporaneity.
So you say that the Renaissance is in its infancy. What indicates that to you?
When I say infancy, it's also relative, you know. I'm talking essentially Iqbal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
100 years ago, it has not moved.
Sure, sure.
Despite, you see, you know, mushrooming of groups which are bona fide in trying to, you know, recapture that spirit. But it hasn't caught on yet, yeah. Few people seem to realize that, for example, the Tunisian situation, when they talk about the Arab Spring, Tunisia was one of the earliest in terms of trying to bring about this progress. Mm-hmm. Anyway, coming back to your point, no, I do not subscribe to the assertion that Sharia law remains cast in stone. And once we take that aside and we accept the fact that it is dynamic, there are ways where we can develop that in many aspects. And I'm not talking about political Islam here. So the fear is when you say Sharia can take care of civilization and take care of society in its modern context, there is always the fear. What does that leave you? Does that leave you with the fact that you must end up with a political Islamic state? No. That is a separate forum anyway, but I can state as a matter of principle, I do not support that kind of concept. I'm talking about matters, for example, pertaining to the law of personal status. Yeah, matters of divorce, adoption, inheritance can be fine-tuned. It's already well established. Matters pertaining to family law. Yeah, the rights of the, especially of women who are divorced. Yeah, the question of who should be the ones who are adjudicating when it comes to issues like this. Why are there only men or predominantly male, yeah, jurists and judges presiding over family cases? Those are things that can be improved. Not marginally, exponentially. And those are the things. When it comes to the realm of constitutional law, when it comes to the realm of political law in relation to the administration, I have a different view. Somebody is going to ask you, why is there a separation? It's a separation because of the concept of what we view Islam is and what Sharia is.
Where do you think the interesting questions and experiments are happening today in the Islamic world? I mean, Tunisia is... You can't ignore that. You can't ignore the dynamics in Tunisia. It's not necessarily linear. It hasn't been straightforward. But you see a lot of interesting changes and developments. Yeah. Indonesia is possibly another place, right? Yeah. Where else?
Okay, well, I think you have basically, you know, pinpointed the two most important areas. First of all, number one, we have got to get away from this Arabic, Middle Eastern-centric, yeah, aspect of Islam. When people talk of Islam, the discourse seems to be centered, you know, straight into the Middle East, mm-hmm, and, you know, where we have all kinds of other problems which are essentially geopolitical and not religious. that's where people get mixed up. Granted, yeah, the initial part of the modernist movement started in the Middle East. You've got people like Muhammad Abduh and so on. Yeah, but over years, and historically speaking, there is this great place known as Nusantara. Mm-hmm. And you have Nusantara Islam.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, of course, is largely, presided over by Indonesia by virtue of the strength of its population. But that would apply to Southeast Asia, many other parts. Now, this too, you could see, if you juxtapose, you can see some major differences here. Mm-hmm. Number one, Nusantara Islam is more accommodative of the culture that is inherent in the place. The local culture, the local customs. Save, of course, with the new rise of this, quote-unquote, shall we say, I don't want to sound too controversial, but you have this new movement, the Salafist movements, which say that you are following these practices, they are all bid'ah, mm-hmm. pernicious innovation. Mm-hmm. And then you start labeling people with this kind of things and they've got certain experiences which are pretty bad. Apart from that, you have basically an Islam, representing something that grows and which is adaptive and inclusive. Yeah, and that is one good way of looking at it and how it can progress. Keeping aside, for example, Aceh, which has, tried to impose a so-called more pristine brand of Islam. But overall, you see, the politics of hate, militarism, extremism failed. Mm-hmm. In the end, those who were voted in were people who were essentially, you don't call them secular, but they are practical minded. Mm-hmm. Islam is to be practiced by society in the original context of what it is. When you move it to the realm of politics, a lot of permutations. And so far, you see that they are essentially negative. Mm-hmm. Going back to the Middle East, the failure of Middle East has nothing to do with Islam. Mm-hmm. Even though you call it, Arab Spring and all that, it was Arab, geopolitical.
Mm-hmm. Now, the trend is always to look back, like who figured it out, right? Mm-hmm. So there'll be somebody will be loyal to this scholar, another person will be loyal to another scholar. Then the questions of where it went wrong, the doors of Ijtihad were closed and so on and so forth. Is that necessarily how the discussion has to go? Or is there a way where we can embrace the present, contemporaneity,
yeah.
a kind of forward-looking attitude rather than just this endless romanticism or nostalgia?
Yeah, yeah. Probably what you're talking about is actually the question of taqlid. I have written some
pages.
Well,
not necessarily taqlid either, yeah. but just the nature of the intellectual exercise when it comes. It's always about things were great before, there was this golden age and we sort of lost our way. And then there'll be some reference to going back to a scholar from the past. I mean, it's very simplistic in its attitude to what happened before, And oftentimes glossing. I mean, they would highlight the great parts and maybe have no idea about the bad parts, So, I mean, maybe there's a virtue in that, right? I'm not so attached to that sort of nostalgia. But yeah, maybe it's not a bad thing. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you're right. I appreciate the fact that, too much going back to the past is not going to get you anywhere. And when somebody says that, Islam is this, and you say, no, Islam was supposed to be like this and it didn't happen. Yeah. But some perspective is always important. Yeah, my history can liberate you. Yeah. It can also imprison you, So what we do is that we have to try to look into sense and to put it as to what were the good things that were already there and tried and tested that could be used now. Bearing in mind that you have got to break away from the past only to move to the future. If you are a Muslim, for example, you say that you do not want to run afoul of the injunction that you have to follow the rule of Sharia, which again is subject to a lot of interpretations. But even then you can do it. Yeah. If you have, and if you appreciate, that Islam is about a growing body, it's about dynamism and progress, and that you need not be tied to the past all the time. But there is nothing inherently wrong in being tied to the past mm-hmm. if you use it as a way to motivate yourself and to get inspired by what it is.
Yeah. Final question, Doctor. Right now, because of the global interest around questions about the Sharia, there's a cottage industry of books around the topic. I'm sure you know so yourself. Yeah. How is your book positioned and all that? I mean, what sets your book apart than, say, all the other books out there that our listeners are considering?
Yeah, it would be audacious of me to try to justify to say how my book should be set apart. All I can tell you is that why I wrote this book. I wrote this book to bring clarity to the subject because there's a lot of misunderstanding about the Sharia. not of negative views, and also there are some strong positions in favour of it. Mm-hmm. So these positions have got to be clarified. There is also the question about, you know, going back to Sharia means going back to desert law and try to demystify and basically contradict. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I want to make it clear that what we have now is not good enough. Mm-hmm. So everybody must get into this. Because one final word which we didn't get to talk about is that there is this jumping into the bandwagon. Everybody's talking about Maqasid. Maqasid of Sharia. You know, they are kind of like a talk fest.
Yes, all with, yes.
There's the point where this has to stop. What kind of Maqasid are we talking about? Are we talking about those that are still linked to the confines of, say, Al-Shatibi? You know, good. But, you know, the sort of compartmentalization of five categories, you have to break free from there.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise we'll be, you know, talking about the same thing all over again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm all for breaking free, Doctor. Now, your book is The Province of Sharia Determined, Fundamental Rethink of the Sharia. It's available from IBT Books, and you can get it, I suppose, at the nearest MPH, Times, perhaps?
Times, Kino.
Kino, yeah. As well. And how can our...
Online as well, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Online. IBT yes, Books has yes. a very efficient online purchasing system. Now, how can our listeners get in touch with you? Are you on Twitter? Are you on Facebook? Or?
Yeah, probably. I'm not really into that kind of stuff.
That kind
yes,
of stuff,
yes,
all right.
Yes.
But you can email the show and we can forward our comments or messages.
I would appreciate that, yes.
Doctor, it is bfmnightschool@gmail.com or look us up on Facebook, BFM Night School. Just type that on the search space. And be sure to like it if you haven't yet. Once again, thanks a lot for joining us. This is a very rich discussion.
Thank you for having me. Yes.
You are Dr. Faiz Abdullah. And once again, your book is The Province of Sharia Determined, Fundamental Rethink of the Sharia. It's available in major bookstores near you. Be sure also to download the app at either the Apple App Store or Google Play, where you can follow all of BFM's wonderful shows. Once again, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. Our guest this week is Dr. Faiz Abdullah, and we've been discussing his book, The Province of Sharia Determined, and this is Night School on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.